Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you. Thanks again for listening to another episode of All Better. I'm your host, Joe Van Wee. Today's guest is my friend, Brian Ettis. Brian is a political ward leader in Northeast Philadelphia. Was raised in a blue-collar family and is open about his recovery. Brian has a rich history as a political staffer, political campaigner, local 98 employee, and in leadership at the Building Trades Council. Today we talk about Brian's entry into recovery, the relationship between labor and addiction, unemployment, and the rise of addiction. Also, the relationships between organized labor and a healthy and active democracy. We also speak a little bit about the future of unions with the rise of technology, especially artificial intelligence, and what the union is doing to prepare for that in job training and preparing its membership for job placement with its new education center. So let's meet Brian. Hello, we're here with Brian Ettis. Brian, I met a few years ago on some political races, fighting and organizing for labor, and we had an immediate rapport. So I'd like to thank you, Brian, for coming on.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate you inviting me.
Brian, what's your official title now? What's the handle you go by?
So I am the business agent for the Philadelphia Building Trades Construction. We cover the 5 counties of southeastern PA, including Philadelphia.
Wow. And how many people does that entail that are part of the organization?
So we boast well over 55,000 members as part of our council, similar to the Philadelphia AFL-CIO. We're the umbrella organization to represent all building and construction trades.
Wow. So I want to get to that before we take a slow walk towards labor, your position, your vocation, your mission. Where did you grow up? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
So I've lived my entire life in Philadelphia, neighborhood called Longcrest. It's in the lower end of Northeast Philadelphia. It's a blue collar, poor to middle class neighborhood.
Yeah. And would you consider your childhood pleasant? Was it rough down there? What was going on?
So I always say, I came from a loving home. It wasn't a lack of love, but on paper, certainly lots of dysfunction. My mother was 17 when she was pregnant with me, 18 when I was born. I grew up in my grandparents' basement. I didn't meet my father until I was 7 years old, direct results of addiction. But like I said, definitely, a loving home. So I didn't miss a meal. So I wasn't that.
Without missing a good Irish meal, what was your understanding, if you had to look back, say, pre-drinking, of what the term alcoholic
drug addict, what context would you frame that in your young mind? What did you think that condition was?
Sure. I mean, you know, I know at family parties, functions, you know, events, it always centered around alcohol. And typically, you know, as a young child, there was an attraction there for me, you know, for drinking, because it was always associated with fun. Unfortunately, you know, the nights didn't always end, you know, in fun. You know, a lot of police calls, fighting, you know, a lot of chaos that always, you know, centered around, you know, alcohol and what the end of the night looked like.
So you're really from Scranton?
Exactly. Really? Exactly. Like I was saying, you know, same breed, different litter. You know, the only difference between Northeast Philadelphia and Northeast PA is, you know, the bluebird, I guess you could say.
Yeah, absolutely. In regards to that same question, just on the opposite side of the spectrum here, was there any understanding at an early age, early being, say, even to your teenagers, of an idea of recovery, even if it was just in general, say, Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step group, treatment centers? Did that exist in your reality?
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, you know, alcoholism doesn't run in my family. It gallops. you know, my grandfather, you know, my mom's dad, you know, got sober when I was about 5 years old. My father got sober at 8 years old. So the fact that they were able to get sober through Alcoholics Anonymous is really why I feel like I'm where I'm at today. Otherwise, God knows which direction my life would have gone.
Wow. So you did have an early understanding, a familiarity that there's a place that exists where this can treat addiction, alcoholism.
Oh, absolutely. You know, although, you know, they got sober, you know, my father got sober. He used to always joke around and say, you know, early years of sobriety, he was saving up to buy a hoagie. But because he got sober, you know, there was a chance and there was really hope.
Yeah. So along the lines of your connection with alcohol, what did alcohol do for you that maybe couldn't be accomplished by yourself? Like, especially the first time you got drunk, or you remember that euphoric feeling that was like, wow, this is it.
Yeah, no. So I had an uncle who was 9 years older than me, and I used to remember, you know, sitting with him and his friends, being very, very young, and watching them, you know, bounce the quarters into the shot glass cups, you know, playing the drinking games and all that, and, you know, having fun. And I think I was fifth grade, you know, after one of his parties, there was a couple of Guinness Cream Ales that were left over in the refrigerator. You know, so I snagged them from the refrigerator, put them away, you know, hid them somewhere, you know, it was summertime, and me and another buddy of mine, we ended up drinking them back to train tracks, and, you know, they're warm, disgusting. But that feeling that I got, you know, of taking myself out of myself and feeling that like buzz, you know, was definitely a changing moment for me, you know, because I didn't always feel so good about myself. Let's just say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a common story. It's the common denominator. And it seems to be the first thing you need to understand in recovery is that drinking is a solution to something else. And drinking doesn't work anymore. Now what do? I'm screwed. And I hear that story a lot, and so do you. How did the consequences get higher? And it seems like, if I'm not mistaken, from the way you described it, if your addiction started taking off, did it run in contrast against your grandfather and your dad? Were they sober then? Maybe in the height of your addiction, was there this dynamic that there's people around you that kind of know what's going on?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Joe Van Wee. I'm the host of All Better, but I'm also the CEO of Fellowship House. At Fellowship House, we believe long-term recovery requires a personality change as well as a clinical intervention. These ideas can take several months to achieve. Our philosophy is to provide a safe, therapeutic, an exceedingly active environment for patients to achieve these personality changes and find joy in the fellowship of recovery, which will allow for long-term sobriety. We believe that recovery extends beyond treatment and peer-to-peer communities into real life. In Fellowship House, we provide a design for living that focuses on education and service. We have strong relationships with the 12 universities and vocational schools in the area and assure that our fellows pursue their personal goals while entering sobriety. We also stress independence and responsibility, making sure each individual is financially solid and self, and helping to make their community a better place. As a treatment center, Fellowship House offers both residential and outpatient treatment services to individuals and families affected by addiction and alcoholism. We're a DDAP licensed provider of general outpatient, intensive outpatient, and partial hospitalization programming, as well as a level of care assessments. If you want to find out more information about Fellowship House, please visit fellowshiphouses.com.
Oh, yeah. So my grandfather, you know, was involved in AA. He would take speaking commitments. But I want to say it was probably after he was sober about 10 years or so, he was helping his brother, you know, my uncle, also struggling with addiction. He ended up dying out in California, you know, due to this disease. And, you know, he wasn't really as active in AA, in recovery, but he was still, you know, a good member and would always answer the call. My father, you know, he is very well known, you know, throughout this region, you know, in recovery. He has dedicated his life to AA. You know, so for me, when I was, you know, doing my thing, I would never bring my stuff home. You know, I was always out, you know, on the streets, you know, drinking and drugging. And, you know, that doesn't mean that I didn't bring, you know, some stuff home. I was always getting, you know, in the fights and, you know, doing some nonsense. Really my drinking, you know, took off in high school. And, you know, I would say by the time I was a junior in high school, you know, there wasn't too many days that had gone by where I wasn't drinking, you know, sometimes 5, even 7 days a week, because again, you know, it really, you know, was the solution for me for all the things that I was feeling as a young teenager.
And if I can just kind of lay on top of this, if it makes sense, the story of labor had to start early on, and what a job and an identity and what a wage is. Is this story already started in your life? Is it interwoven into that neighborhood? How did that kind of lay on top of or underneath your addiction at that time?
I mean, yeah, no. And thank God for AA, and thank God that, you know, my dad got sober and, you know, dedicated his life to AA. You know, the labor roots for me, you know, it's really deeply rooted in my family. My great grandfather was, you know, Schuylkill County. My dad's side of the family, his father was all Schuylkill County. You know, my great grandfather was an organizer, treasurer with the United Mine Workers. And then my grandmother's father, he was an organizer in the CIO before they merged with the AFL. And, you know, I think it was 1955. Before they merged there, he was an organizer with the Machinist Union. And then my dad, once he got sober for a brief time in the 90s, he was also an organizer in the Teamsters. You know, and, you know, I used to walk picket lines when I was like 9, 10 years old, you know, with him, you know, and I saw what the hard fought sacrifice that was made, you know, to get better wages and standards, you know, in the workplace at a very early age. And, you know, it just really became a passion, you know, witnessing firsthand the type of battles and fights, you know, that would happen, you know, with labor unions. And for me, you know, I'm a fighter, I'm from Philly. So I was really, really attracted to that.
Yeah. Any good boy would be, right? That's, I The first time I got a real flair for it was the first film, like could see it visually what preceded me, not in labor, but Jimmy Hoffa, when Nicholson played Jimmy Hoffa, the scenes where they would just be preparing to march.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, I was trying to compare, how is this not a war movie? What is it?
Yeah.
With now, Danny DeVito, just always having pistol whipping somebody. That was great.
No, and that's the thing that people forget, you know, not in the, you know, far distant past, you know, people died, you know, for organized labor. Lives were lost, you know, and the way it was explained to me was that a lot of times with labor disputes and fights, you know, you would need to take, you know, as a worker, you would need to take that black eye, the broken arm, the broken leg, broken ribs, you know, figuratively to give the company, you know, a black eye just to kind of get a fair shake, you know. Again, it always goes back to, you know, wages and standards, you know, in the industry. And that's really what we're fighting for. You know, we're fighting for the workers, that they have a say and that we, you know, are able to come up with a good agreement that both sides may not be exactly thrilled about, but both sides get their fair share.
Well, I want to depart from your story and come back to what produced your recovery. But while we're here, I mean, this is what I wanted to discuss with you and be a little more educated on, or some of my listeners. And I like things that start with, like, you know, grounding principles, labor, 10,000 years of labor. Let's fast forward, you know, we're only a couple hundred years away from when you were born. You would have been attached to a plot of land in Europe if you're from a Western culture. Other minorities are in a disproportionate, were always exploited the last couple hundred years. You find the rise of our country, let's just say the last 120 years, the real labor movement that's substantial, that gets complex, that fights for human dignity, that kids in where I grew up aren't in a mine 6 days a week for 10 hours. John Mitchell and, you know, the Scranton iron furnaces kind of, I think a lot of people are out of touch in my area with how many battles were fought in the streets, even in our town, Scranton, that produced the substantial freedoms we get to experience as Americans. I don't think there is freedoms without organized labor and any, or we'll lose them. Can you speak to why what I'm saying may be right? Like, in that sense, like, real liberty has been provided by organized labor?
Listen, you are not only right, you are spot on. Organized labor has always been the point of the spear fighting for all families, not just union families, but all working families. And at the end of the day, you know, from the history, you know, up until present, you know, we're on the front lines. You know, organized labor is always on the front lines. And that can, you know, transfer from, you know, wages and standards in the workplace to even, you know, when we're talking about addiction, you know, for us, you know, families, you know, we go through, you know, crisis, and all families have them. I don't care who you are, you know, no matter what creed, color, sect, denomination, you know, religion you believe in, you know, families go through, you know, trials and tribulations when it comes to life. You know, as I've heard before, life gets lifey sometimes, you know, and things happen, you know, but organized labor has always been on the front lines of all those battles. You know, they really, really have.
So I gave like a broad description of stuff we are removed from, like child labor laws and stuff, but let's focus even the last 40 years, things that I think my generation already takes for granted at a basic job of holidays off, paid holidays, overtime, FMLA rights. How are they received by the workforce, and what did labor organization have to do with that?
And again, that all goes back to the battle and the fight, you know, that, again, it was brought to you by organized labor. We don't have holidays, right? We don't have vacation. We don't have, you know, good wages if it's not for organized labor. And I even think today, some of the challenges that we're faced with, you know, as young adult and people that are coming out of, you know, high school currently, you know, a lot of times, you know, at least for my generation, your generation too, Joe, because I think we're relatively close to the same age. You were looked at or frowned upon if you didn't go to college. You were looked at as a failure. You know, and I even remember my grandfather, love him to death. I didn't go to college right out of high school. I went to work. You know, I went to work, you know, in the Teamsters. And I remember my grandfather, cause he's like, you're so smart. Like what a waste it is that, you know, you're not going to college. Well, fast forward, you know, 20 plus years later, you know, I think we're all realizing, we're all saying that like college is not the solution for everybody. Right. Yeah. And we need those manufacturing jobs. We need those good paying middle-class jobs, you know, in order to provide, you know, a middle-class life. And that again, doesn't happen, or at least we don't have those type of wages if it's not for organized labor.
Yeah. It's, that's a complex thing. You see like that generational thing pushing, hey, be a lawyer. Be a doctor, like even two generations behind us, and everyone goes to college. You get $100,000 worth of debt for, you know, a paper that shows that you're trainable.
$100,000 worth of debt if you're lucky.
Yeah. And what's the property owned with that? What's the asset? And then for the next 10 years, you're trying to make enough money that you just borrowed to purchase, you know, a piece of land, which preceding education was your right to liberty, that you can own property. There's a kind of amnesia to the history of labor and property rights providing freedom, and now we're being told how to consume to get into freedom. I guess that's its own story, but I see labor, and not only from being friends with you, my understanding, where I'm from, it runs in tandem with protecting democracy. I don't see a population having a voice that threatens not only big business rights, dignity, but the actual act of democracy. If people can't organize a voice, they're not threatening to anybody.
It's the truth. It's the truth. And, you know, you see the battles with the big banks, you know, they always seem to, you know, come out on top. You know, it's usually always passed down. The cost is always passed down to the poor and the middle class. I don't see any other avenue for, you know, people from my neighborhood in order to get out if they're not able to get, you know, good middle class paying jobs. And not to you know, keep belaboring this point, but like I'm thinking to myself today, you know, with the rise of interest rates, you know, with inflation and, you know, the cost of, you know, goods, and you have that $100,000+ debt, you know, are you going to be able to afford to buy a car? You know, where are you going to live? How are you going to raise a family? You know, we are at a turning point right now where it's just almost like impossible to get ahead. It's like you need to make $150,000 plus a year just to be middle class. You know, if you're a kid with college with debt that's coming out and going into the workforce, and you're getting offered jobs of, you know, $50,000. Well, guess what? $50,000 in 2023 is not what $50,000 was back in 2008. You know,
and it hasn't changed, but you know, profits have changed, margins have changed for owner, but like wages have not changed, and inflation keeps going up, and it's not matching the cost of wages. Now you're centered in Philadelphia, and you know, unions and labor have been, I guess, the right target to destroy if you want to fight for big business and an ownership class to have enormous margins and not recognize the labor that produced those margins with any fair or equitable distribution of it. When you don't have organized labor, no one could combat that. And the government's not going to catch up if a population's not complaining. Or, I mean, you could just look at France. There's kind of some admiration. I'd never say I admire France, but like the sense that they're in the streets over retirement ages. And I think there's been a real loss of that here because of so many damaging hits, say, to automakers in Detroit, what you've seen in other brothers and sisters of labor. And I wanted to talk a little bit. The point I'm trying to make is unemployment then skyrockets, and you had a labor force there. You had some unions who fought hard but the labor changes. There's a market shift of either production or technology that attacks labor. So I'm not talking about greed attacking labor. I wanted to focus on technology attacking labor market forces. This gets tough. So there's a relationship I always see with unemployment and addiction when it rises, or the loss of the dignity of having a job or a wage that's protected. Addiction can replace this distress. And what are you guys doing to discuss? I know you're in the trades, but the loss of maybe technology replacing some of these services, is the union having discussions of what that could look like in the next 10 years?
Yeah. So for us in our business, you know, as we like to say, you know, for me, you know, as an agent, I don't get paid to tell you what's down at the end of the block, right? anybody can tell you what's going on down at the end of the block. I got to know what's going to happen or what's going on around the corner.
Yeah.
You know, and how you get that answer is, you know, can be a complex issue. And as far as, you know, labor and unemployment and, you know, the trades in particular, you know, for us, you know, we go to work every day that we go to work. Unlike a lot of other industries, we're working ourselves out of a job, you know, because once that project is complete and it's finished, right, the job is over. So without unemployment as a safety net, right, like, you know, we're going to be not only poor, but, you know, we're going to be out of a house, you know, our kids are going to be, you know, struggling. So we really, really, you know, rely on unemployment compensation. And in Pennsylvania, you know, unemployment compensation has not been raised in decades. You know, I think what was the last number, it's like $576 or so or something like that, you know, after they take the tax out. You know, I don't know what family, you know, in today's standards can survive on $576 or whatever the number is now, if it's over that number. I don't know what family can really survive on that on a weekly basis. But for us, like, that sometimes can just pay the bills. You know, as far as, like, you know, how we're able to fight, you know, we're fighting with Harrisburg right now in order to raise the rates, you know, yeah, for unemployment. You know, our neighbor in state, New Jersey, I think they're well over $300 more a week, you know, in their unemployment, you know, compensation wages. You know, there are other industries, you know, and how is it directly connected, you know, with addiction? Let's just say this. You know, when people are getting sober, it's not because, you know, life is grand and, you know, things are bad. You know, typically when you're getting sober, you know, all scorecards read zero. And that's what it was like for me. You know, I was, you know, on the brink of, you know, the wife leaving. You know, she was pregnant with my son at the time. My daughter was, you know, before she was even 3 years old, she was like 2.5 years old. I was laid off. You know, I couldn't get to work, you know what, yeah, I mean? So I have firsthand life experience of knowing what that's like, you know, and if it's not for unemployment, you know, what do you do? What do you do at that point?
And what did you do? How did that produce your recovery, the end of the road?
So it was a bit of a fast track for me, even though my initial feeling and thought was, you know, how dare she leave me? You know, doesn't she know how good she has it? You know, because again, you know, drinking and, you know, drugs, you know, clouding your mind and your thoughts and your feelings. I was really like disconnected from reality. But after, you know, some time of being, you know, at home alone, you know, cause she had left and gone to, you know, her mom's house, you know, and I couldn't get up for work. I couldn't get out of bed. That was a eye awakening moment for me, and you know, the pain got great enough, as they said, and you know, I started to, you know, really, really like reflect and take a look at like how bad things were. You know, for a long time, my last couple of years of drinking, I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I was really sick of the person I had become, you know, and thank God, you know, my dad was sober. You know, thank God that, you know, that he was in my life and I was able to, you know, to turn to him and ask for guidance and direction. Although he didn't get involved in my recovery, you know, he just put me in touch with the right people, you know, spiritual giants. You know, I got picked up, I was taken to my first AA meeting and I remember walking down the steps, of that meeting thinking that like, I didn't belong there, because I wasn't on Kensington Avenue. I didn't lose my house. You know, things weren't the, you know, the worst. And, you know, one of the first things that, you know, was shared with me when I had said that was, well, how low do you want your bottom to be? You know, do you want to lose everything? Because that's what's going to happen. And, you know, I went into that AA meeting and the guy that was speaking, he was sober well over 30 years. He was probably in his later 70s. And the first thing I thought was like, I'm not going to relate to this guy. Like, I don't have anything in common with him. And from the time he spoke to the time he finished, I related to every single thing that that man had shared. Like, and the seed was planted. And again, you know, good news, bad news, with my dad being sober, I always thought like, well, I know my dad's sober. Like, I know how not to be an alcoholic. But what I didn't know was that once I took that drink and that drink took me, all bets were off and I was no longer had a choice, you know, and what the outcome of my day or my night or my week was going to be. Cause I was, you know, I got that taste on my lips and I couldn't stop.
When did you realize that recovery was more than just not drinking? Like there was going to be some other fundamental things that either had to change or that you wanted to change, that you're like, okay, drinking was just kind of the beginning, putting the plug in the jug.
Yeah. That's a great question. And I was just sharing this, you know, with my girlfriend, Catherine, which by the way, I ended up getting a divorce after getting sober, but that's life. Life gets lifey, as they say. But I was just having that conversation. Thank God. And you know, Joe, you know, you can get sober, you know, and, you know, life doesn't always get better. You don't always make the right choices and, you know, you can end up, you know, going down the wrong path, even in sobriety. But thank God I was put in touch with the right people. Like I said, spiritual giants, you know, men of honor and dignity. And I was going to the right AA meetings. And the things that I would hear from them is, you know, like, you know, one of the most spiritual things you can do, you know, in sobriety is pay child support. You know what I mean? You know, take care of your responsibilities. You know, and I had a lot of debt coming into sobriety, you know, financial insecurity was certainly a big, big thing for me. You know, I remember too, you know, I learned early on in sobriety, like, you know, some of the cliches that you would hear in the rooms that, you know, alcohol gave you the wings to fly, but took away the sky. And that really hit home for me. Because for drinking and me and my life, like that was always the solution. And then getting sober, you know, and going to AA and just being so like bottled up because I stuffed everything down. Like I was not one to share like where I was really at, you know, mentally and emotionally, you know, and then all of a sudden now I'm in the room and you want me to talk about where I'm at and what's going on. And I'm like, I'm not really there yet, you know? Yeah. So I just kept bringing the body. And as they say, I kept bringing the body and eventually the mind showed up. And, you know, because of the men in the rooms of AA, I was able to, you know, share exactly where I was going and getting that good orderly direction, as they say, you know, and making better life choices. And little by little, instead of digging that hole deeper and deeper, I started to fill it in and things started to get better. You know, and, you know, so my answer to that is that like you get, you know, plugged in with the right people, you know, and, you know, for me, you know, it was men in AA, you know, would help me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's real. And that is the first thing that happens is the connection starts already heal you, that you trust a guy. You could tell them what's going on and then the fantasy and the secrets could fade away and you start to become whole again. In that process that I know you experience, when did it become apparent that you're going to be drawn towards labor, leadership, or the union? How did that evolve? If you had to give a summary from around the point of early sobriety to present day, what did that look like? How did that happen?
So I remember, you know, being on the bar stool, you know, my addiction, and thinking like, ah, you know, I could do that. I could be a business agent, you know, I could, but that dream was just not, it was just not possible. You know, and honestly, in early sobriety, like I was just trying to stay sober. So I really didn't know where my life would end up taking me. I actually ended up getting hurt. I was sober. I was doing, you know, I was working, you know, on a, you know, a big mall. I had a freight elevator door come crashing down on me. And, wow. You know, I had, three herniated discs, nerve damage going down both legs. You know, my kids were young, you know, every doctor that I went to see, it was, you know, whether it be the workman's comp doctors or my personal doctors, they all told me that I needed to find a new line of work, because if I continued working in construction, my quality of life would be terrible by the time I was 50. You know, so I couldn't just hang it up and retire at that point. You know, I don't think I was even 30 years old yet. I was like, maybe like 30, I may have been like 30 or 31 years old. You know, so I was out, I was collecting workman's comp, and, you know, exploring different, you know, career paths. You know, I looked at possibly being a real estate agent. You know, I had some time in my hands. So I got involved with my local union, with the bricklayers, and I got involved with the politics. And, you know, I really learned firsthand, you know, what politics delivered look like, you know, as it's related to organized labor and the building trades. And, you know, that passion, like, just it really, really took off. You know, prior to 2009, I don't even think I had an email address. I didn't know how to send an email. Necessarily, because I graduated from high school in 97, and computers may have been in the class, but like it was like the old school, like, you know, dark screen with like green letters.
Just knocking, you know, on it. Like,
yeah, exactly. You know, so I started getting involved with politics with my union, and I wasn't getting paid, you know, from the local, from the union. I was doing it because I thought it was the good of the union. You know, and I ended up just, you know, just really like, you know, jumping all in, and I started chasing it, and, you know, I started getting involved in political campaigns, and then I eventually
political campaigns outside of the union. Not like an office. Yeah. Look, was that looking like at the state level, county levels?
Yeah. So the first campaign that I ran was in 2012. It was for a state representative. It was a seat that was held by a Republican for 33 years prior to that. This was a Democrat, and he wasn't running against the incumbent. He had retired, and the district itself was actually getting redistricted out. So I had managed the campaign. I worked and volunteered on a handful of other campaigns in like 2010 and 2011. But this one, I was the manager. And like I said, prior to 2009, I didn't even never send an email. But again, my back was up against the wall, I guess you could say, in the sense that I needed to find a new career path. I was sober. I was getting sober, you know, and thank God that I was. And I just, again, I showed up. 85% of it is showing up, yep. You know, fake it till you make it, as they say.
Yeah.
You know? And things just kind of took off, and really it was a passion. It was something that like I really loved. I loved the action. You know, I loved like, you know, putting in the long hours and fighting, I guess you could say, not like physically fighting, but just, yeah. You know, fighting for the win, you know, and things just really took off.
Well, I probably met you in 2014, 15. You were already an old vet by then. We were in some dogfights and getting some support here for statewide candidates. And you knew exactly what you were doing. So you kind of get this tutelage of a, like, good mentorship, the desire, and then the physical situation forced you to a new skill set. but it went into a skill set that you could be a leader and represent the guys that you're cut from, your brothers.
Yeah.
How did you run for a seat in the union? How does that look like to someone who would not be familiar with that? Is it similar to a race? You put your hat in your name in a hat and.
Yeah. So for me, because of the success that I had in the political world and running campaigns, you know, I had a couple people that really, you know, witnessed and saw the talent that I had. But I actually worked briefly as a chief of staff for that state representative and then eventually even down to city council. But that's really not where I felt like I fit in. You know, I really enjoyed helping people, but my heart, my passion was always with, you know, labor, you know, with the unions. And I got an opportunity to become an organizer, you know, with Local 98, you know, under John Dougherty. And, you know, I worked on, you know, some campaigns, but my heart was always with, you know, it was always with the organizing efforts when it comes to creating hours, you know, for the members and fighting for the members and fighting for, you know, better wages and standards in the workplace.
And for those that don't know who Johnny Doc is, they're just living on the moon. When it comes to American labor.
Absolutely. John was very influential and powerful, you know, in labor politics. You know, he, you know, put the labor movement on his back for quite a while and led the fight, you know, and the level of success could not be, you know, denied, you know, the type of success that he had over his career.
Well, what would you say were the three most important things that you learned under watching him be one of the last kind of stalwarts of protection for labor? And it seems that he made Philadelphia this impenetrable place still left for labor, because a lot of places, I mean, they're getting picked off, and there seemed to be an organization in Philadelphia and a commitment to politics and having a voice. What were your takeaways that maybe you'll always keep with you? And what are the things you feel maybe in the last 3 or 4 years now that you're leading the way you are, that you had to either change or new tools that you think the union has to use moving forward? Sure.
Yeah. So the one thing that I didn't need to learn, you know, was hard work, dedication, and loyalty. You know, and I saw that firsthand. You know, he just cared passionately, and he would always pound everybody, you know, agents, organizers, that, you know, this is not a job. This is a lifestyle, and it's 24/7, 365. And there's never a time where you cannot take the call from a member, you know, when they need something, to fight for them, you know. So that is something that, like I said, was already there for me. But watching it firsthand and seeing how that unfolds was definitely an experience, and something that I'll never, ever, ever stop doing, you know. You know, just really at the end of the day, like it's really about the members, and it's really about, you know, creating hours, you know, and organizing and making sure that, you know, that, you know, like I said, that, you know, seeing what's down at the end of the block is good, but we need to see what's around the corner, you know, and creating a 10-year plan, you know, for labor movement, because that's really how things move in our industry. You know, you can plan for, you know, what's going to be 30, 60 days from now, but you really got to think about what's going to be happening, you know, 10 years from now. And, you know, working on that Supreme Court race in 2015, it was the first time in over 300 years you had three vacancies on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And we know from labor's position, you know, that was not only critical for survival, you know, for labor unions, because that's ultimately where, you know, all decisions, you know, end, you know, for organized labor, because prevailing wages are always on the table. Right to work is always on the table, you know, and if we, you know, at the end of the day, if those three seats end up being won by Republicans, their mindset and their ideals aren't always fit with us. Not to say that there's not, you know, pro-labor Republicans out there, because there are. You know,
Your ideology is clear. It's labor. Who gives a shit? Yep. The part, if they're protecting your labor, that's who you're voting for. And that was a great year because John's brother won that seat, Kevin.
He sure did.
And, you know, he was a larger than life character, if anyone doesn't have context, and he was a real leader. His hands always amazed me. It was like big catcher's mitts. So before I step off of Johnny Doc, were you there? Did he beat the crap out of some young guy trying to jump on him? And I mean, he had to be 70 years old. I heard he could still toss. Some dude attacked him at a work site.
So I was not there, for that. And, the guy, attacked him and, he had to defend himself. Obviously, there was another story that was maybe shared or said, that's what I heard happen. The guy, went after him, there was a little bit of a scrap and John had to defend himself. And I guess, because the guy didn't win the fight, he had a different story to tell.
Yeah. That was clear to anyone who knew him and was around the scenario, but there was a sense of just awe, his age, stature, and he always had the sharpest sweaters I've ever seen. That he's a big dude. So, looking forward into the future, I guess some ideas organization may be considering is there programs or incentives or plans in the future that labor will be part of, new skill trainings, not only protecting jobs, is there a way to preemptively like stave off, say, AI or new emerging technologies that could do more sophisticated services that are now trades? Is there discussions to start saying maybe labor and the unions should be part of new skills and trainings, almost like education? I mean, what would that look like?
No, I as I'm thinking now, and I do, I really, the level of gratitude that I have, for AA and sobriety, is really unmatched. And at the end of the day, like I'm thinking now about how blessed I really feel between my father, Johnny Doc, and then now Ryan Boyer, who's the business manager of Building Trades. Like I'm really, really blessed by, having direction and guidance from some of the best and greatest labor leaders, that I can ever, come before. And what Ryan has put in place, with a lot of our pre-apprenticeship programs, our inclusion, diversity in the trades when it comes to, having women, people of color, having every opportunity in order to get into the trades. But in a lot of these pre-apprenticeship programs, we're talking about, just being, state of the art, cutting edge, making sure that the workforce really reflects what the neighborhood looks like. And as far as like, AI and a lot of that stuff, Joe, I can talk to, Ryan about having you coming down and doing a tour of the Sam Staten Jr. pre-apprenticeship program. You got to see this place. I mean, it looks like an accredited, top class Ivy League college when you walk through this building, and they have all types of, innovative training, that they go over, and then even over at Local 98. You got Mark Lynch, who's the business manager over there. They have a whole training where you pop on these glasses. It's interactive and they can place you anywhere in the world and you can work in a safe environment and you can work with, in a nuclear plant, you can work, in a life science lab, and you put on these gloves and these glasses and you're literally doing it like an innovative way that is like, decades and light years ahead. Like you said, it's funny, when you said about Scranton being 10, 20 years behind sometimes, Philadelphia has always really led, the charge when it comes to the building trades, in this country, whether it be the way that we have our organizing efforts or the way that we go after, the work that's going to be coming down the pike in the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, that's exciting stuff. And I was very curious about that. So in lines of any of those 55,000 members, they start not showing up for work one day, depression, maybe messing up at the job, and you know it's addiction related. What is the kind of protocol that you guys use to approach someone with addiction, or they approach you and need help? What does that look like?
Yeah. So fortunately for me, you know, when I was, you know, early years of sobriety, you know, working, you know, on the job with the tools, you know, a lot of times you can know when somebody's really, you know, going through a difficult time. You know, I was one of those guys that was going through a difficult time, and being able to, you know, meet other, you know, men or women on the jobs that are in sobriety, you know, was a blessing, because, you know, you got your head in between your legs, you know, and you're full of shame and guilt and remorse, you know, and you're struggling with life. You know, fast forward now, 2023, you know, many of our trades, we have mentorship programs, you know, we have drug and alcohol specialists that work directly, you know, for individual trade unions, you know, and I feel like the, you know, the opportunities, or at least the, I don't want to call it promotion, because it's more about attraction as we're taught, but a lot of the, you know, the programs that are out there, aren't like hitting like they were, you know, 10, 20, even, you know, 30 years ago, where it was unheard of to talk about that on a job. I remember, you know, at certain points, you know, hearing about, like, you know, people would bring 30 packs onto the job. That just doesn't happen anymore. You know,
I had a wrestling coach that would shoot the coach. They would drink at wrestling practice. It was just Scranton life.
Listen. And I know, like, you know, we're always constantly evolving and dealing with different things. Like, I remember being on the job site, you know, walking down the hallway, like, I got a baby rattle in my pocket, you know what I mean? And you know, instead of calling them Percocets, they call them Workocets, you know what I mean? Because you needed to take them in order to keep on working, because you get banged up, you know, in our industry. But there really are, I don't think it's as much of a secret now with the opportunities and the programs that are out there, you know, whether if you get your opportunity to get into a rehab. But the real success that I've seen personally has been through, you know, AA or NA, you know, when you're really struggling and having that, you know, person to turn to, that you can talk about, like, when you're struggling with life, or you're struggling with the bills, or you're struggling with, you know, fighting with your significant other, your spouse, you know, and you don't have to turn to, you know, a drink or a drug in order to get that solution, but you can turn to the person, and they can talk about their experience and how they were able to stay sober through a difficult time. That's really the most powerful and impactful thing that I've seen, you know, in my time in recovery. And, you know, we have that network down here in Philadelphia. You know, AA and NA is really, really strong, you know, in this region. You know, we went through the pandemic, you know, and getting to a physical meeting may have been difficult and tough for people, but I was just at a meeting last Friday, you know, and the woman that was speaking, you know, she was a Zoom baby, I guess you can say, you know, where she did almost her entire recovery, you know, on Zoom meetings. You know, so there are really lots of ways in order for you to talk to another person, you know, in you know, recovery, that can share their experience, you know, and give you some hope that there's a solution and that there's a way out of it.
Well, Brian, we're winding down, and I promised you 50 minutes, but before we kind of wrap up here, is there anything I didn't ask you that you think you'd like to say about how to contact the unions, or people reaching out for help, or something I didn't ask?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know if we really missed anything. We talked about just letting things flow, and I think they did, you know, when it comes to, you know, AA, or, you know, I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because my drink bone, you know, is connected to my drug bone, but everything always started and stopped with a drink with me. And that's really where, as a matter of fact, I even said at one time, like, I started smoking, you know, weed to slow my drinking down, you know, and then that became, like, you know, everything. But no, truthfully, you know, if I'm giving advice, or if I'm making a suggestion to anybody that's, you know, struggling, you know, staying sober, you know, jump in, you know, jump into this lifeboat, you know, don't jump out, you know, for me, you know, it was always a, and I'm going to be very polite and I say this, but like, you know, kind of like if things go wrong in life, you know what I mean? Like just hang in there, just stay in and you can turn to another person, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous or NA or whatever, you know, recovery you step into, you know, for that solution, because nothing justifies a drink or a drug.
Roger that. Brian, I want to thank you. And anything coming down the pike, I'd like to reach out soon. I hope you'd come on again sometime.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, man.
Thank you. Bye.
I'd like to thank you for listening to another episode of All Better. You can find us on allbetter.fm or listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Alexa. Special thanks to our producer, John Edwards, and engineering company 570 Drone. Please like or subscribe to us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And if you're not on social media, you're awesome. Looking forward to seeing you again. And remember, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're right.
Hi, this is Joe Van Wee, your host of All Better. I had a few announcements. If you're interested in subscriber content, which we're about to launch, this would be STEP workshops, cognitive behavioral therapy tools, and mindfulness practices that are approachable and can be very useful in reducing anxiety, rumination, and depression. Please send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. And if you like the episodes that you've been hearing very much, please stop by Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and a small review. This helps us stay relevant in the field of content and helping people and their families with substance use disorder. Thank you.